Hello and welcome to IT Conversations, a series of interviews, recordings, and transcripts on the hot topics of information technology. I'm your host, Doug Kay, and in today's special program, I'm pleased to bring you a presentation from the O'Reilly Open Source Convention held in Portland, Oregon, July 26th through 30th, 2004.
And now it's time for our first keynote of the morning. As originally conceived, we would have Freeman Dyson and his children, Esther Dyson and George Dyson, but Esther is presently stuck in Dallas. And as Tim observed, that's being stuck in Texas is somewhat like our nation's plight right now. So I'm sure we all have a lot of sympathy for her. If you could just imagine somebody else sitting up here and doing their email during the keynote, then you've got the sense of it. So right now we have the Father, the Son, and we'll set a place for the Holy Ghost. So I don't know if you know, are familiar with Freeman Dyson. He worked at the Princeton Institute for Advanced Study with Hans Bethe and Richard Feynman, the very famous Richard Feynman. His largest contribution to science was the unification of the three versions of quantum mechanics invented by Feynman, Schwinger, and Tominaga. No mean claim to fame there. But since then, he's made a name for himself writing books and speaking and giving us the benefit of his deep thoughts. As a testament to how impressive his thinking processes are, Cornell made him a professor, glossing over the fact that he himself did not have a PhD. They need to speak to me about that. Our other Dyson today is George Dyson, whom I hope you all remember. From last year's fabulous keynote. I haven't seen very many keynotes at technical conferences get standing ovations, but this one did. His sense of history and his sensitivity to the processes and thinking behind science and open source and computing in general really moved us last year. So we're very happy to have him back. And the discussion between George and Freeman and the virtual Esther will be moderated by our very own Tim O'Reilly. So please give them all a great welcome.
So actually, we wanted to start this session. George has a little video he wants to show us. So maybe that's just the right way to start.
This is for Freeman, who needs no introduction. But
Captain, I have identified the signal. It is from the USS Ginolan, a Federation transport ship reported missing in this sector 75 years ago.
Code 1 Alpha 0, ship in distress.
Things out of war, Benson. All stop.
Aye, sir.
Report. We have entered a massive gravitational field, Captain.
There are no stars or other stellar bodies listed on our navigational charts. However, sensors indicate the presence of an extremely strong gravitational source in this vicinity.
Can you localize the source of the gravitational field? Sensors?
I'm having difficulty scanning the object. It appears to be approximately 200 million kilometers in diameter.
That's nearly as large as the Earth's orbit around the Sun. Why didn't we detect this before now?
The object's enormous mass is causing a great deal of gravimetric interference. That might have prevented our sensors from detecting it before we dropped out of warp.
Mr. Data, could this be a Dyson sphere?
The object does fit the general parameters of Dyson's theory.
A Dyson sphere? It's a very old theory, number one. I'm not surprised that you haven't heard of it. In the 20th century, a physicist called Freeman Dyson postulated the theory that an enormous hollow sphere could be constructed around a star. This would have the advantage of harnessing all the radiant energy of that star, and any population living on the interior surface would have virtually inexhaustible sources of power. Are you saying you think there are people living in there?
Possibly a great number of people, Commander. The interior surface area of a sphere this size is the equivalent of more than 250 million Class M planets.
Sir, I've located the distress signal. It is coming from a point in the northern hemisphere.
Ensign Rega, put us into synchronous orbit above that position.
Aye, sir.
So, in that regard, I wanted to start by asking you about something you said in a 1978 Omni interview, Freeman. You said, "It's amusing to think that someday all my serious work will probably be a footnote in the textbook when everyone remembers what I did on the side."
No, that's always like that. You never know what's going to catch the eye. Well, that's just fun, of course. That there's nothing. It's a lot of nonsense, but still, it's good fun.
But I mean, how many people here in the audience, you know, when you were kids, first heard the name of Freeman Dyson in connection with the Dyson Sphere? So, but seriously, one of the things that I think is really interesting with the two of you is this really an opportunity for us, Freeman, because you were there, and George, because you've been studying it, to get a sense of history when we think about our own place in technology. You know, this group, there's a huge amount of optimism about how open source software is going to change the world, is changing the world. And in fact, many of us have been involved in the development of world-changing technologies. And yet, you went through a phase in which the technology that you were deeply involved with went from being sort of a hero to being a demon. And perhaps you could reflect a little bit on the sort of the path that technology takes.
Well, at the moment, I'm mostly interested in biotech. Biotech is the technology of the 21st century. I think there's no doubt about that. And the question is, which way is it going? And I think there is a good analogy between open software and a possible future for biotech. That is domestication. That is what made the computer industry fun, what made it a real agent of change all over the world. It produced a complete revolution in international affairs and in all other sorts of ways. Was the fact that computers moved into the household, that they became tools for doing your income tax or doing your homework, that they became games for kids all the way back to 3 years old, so that now our grandchildren are as addicted to their computers, they are attached to their computers more durably than husbands and wives. Till death do us part in sickness and in health, they won't be separated from their computers.
A lot more sickness sometimes than health.
So that development, which has really turned the world upside down, could happen in biotechnology, and I hope it will. Of course, it has a downside, a dark side as well as a bright side. So what I envisage for this coming century is that the passion that you see in a place like the Philadelphia Flower Show, which I visited a few weeks ago, that's the biggest flower show in the world. You see acres and acres of wonderful things, flowers and bushes and bonsai and all kinds of beautiful plants, which people devote their lives to nurturing, and they bring them to the Philadelphia Flower Show to show them off. And then there is the reptile show in San Diego, which is equally good, which is all the, in the Southwest, of course, reptiles grow better than flowers. So you see there a marvelous assemblage of lizards and snakes. The problem for a grandparent is, how do you get out of the building without buying a snake? But anyhow.
But this idea of domestication being a fairly a critical aspect in technology, that at some point...
Well, it does. It opens up the creativity of millions of people in a way you never can do with a monolithic technology. So anyway, what's going to happen? I hope we will see in the next 10 or 20 years, we'll see kits for these gardeners and these snake breeders to use the tools of genetic engineering, horizontal transfer of genes from one species to another, to be creative. This is the new art form of the 21st century. We shall see then the proliferation.
What about the question of risk? Obviously, people turned away from atomic energy because they perceived it as too risky. And there's a lot of concern about the risks of biotech as well.
Yes, indeed there is, and with good reason. I mean, we're all scared of biological weapons. And we have every good reason to be so. So we have, so looking at this prospect of domestication, the biotech game for your kids, you buy the seeds or the eggs or whatever it may be, and then the kid can then compete with his friends to see who can grow the prickliest cactus or who can grow the cutest dinosaur. And what's that going to do to us? Well, I think, I mean, there are essentially five questions we have to answer. First of all, is it possible to put a stop to it? Secondly, is it desirable to put a stop to it? Thirdly, suppose you want to put a stop to it, suppose you want to control it, keep it within safe bounds. What's the appropriate machinery for doing that? How do you set up the laws? How do you set up the enforcement? How do you set up the rules of the game so that creative possibilities of biodiversity can be enjoyed at the same time that you don't allow everybody to produce harmful bugs? The fourth question is... Oh, I've forgotten what the fourth question was. It doesn't matter.
So
you got the point.
Yes. Switching tracks, George, you obviously came here last year and gave us sort of a wonderful history of technology. But I don't know how many people here know that you actually dropped out of the educational system at a young age, went to Pacific Northwest to build kayaks. And maybe you could talk a little bit about that history of, you know, the your rejection of the academic world. I mean, here's, you know, a high school dropout who went and ended up being a fellow at the Institute for Advanced Studies. How did you make that trajectory, and what was that like?
Right, well, I'm still waiting for an honorary degree from my high school. And the thing is that the Princeton educational system, I think this is fairly common, they tried to make a distinction between people who would do things with their hands and people who would do things with their minds. And I think as human beings, we really should do both. And you actually can do some of your best thinking while doing something with your hands. And so I sort of took the other extreme. I just went off to do things with my hands. But that left me a lot of time to do things with my mind, and I think some of my thinking about technology is a result of that, from being sort of not depending on it to the extent that I could see it more objectively. And then I was always I was sort of raised to be a rebel, then there was this...
Did this guy encourage you to be a rebel?
Yeah, really. So I was certainly not discouraged from leaving school. And then had my biography appeared when I was 23, which is sort of crippling.
that's this book, I assume.
Right.
So the Starship and the Canoe.
there I was cast as being sort of the voice for nature against science. And that, I think that... So my nature of rebelling against stereotypes, I now had this stereotype to rebel against, which meant going back to science. So here I am.
So can you talk a little bit more about this idea of making things? One of the things, I mentioned this in my talk yesterday, that I see more and more people starting to get out of dealing with just making software, instead making things that affect the physical world. At Nat's party last night, people were talking about, Brian Aker was talking about hacking the thermostats and the heating system in his house. There's people who are hacking on cars. There's people who are, increasingly... I have a friend who shows up and his little Casio XLM camera doesn't have a macro lens, and so he actually made one himself, and use a laser cutter to make a little clasp to fasten it on. I mean, people are making things now, and you were doing that 20 years ago.
Well, we all were, and I'm very happy to see that, because really, I mean, and I'm speaking about America, but I think it's true of other countries. I mean, our American rite of passage, as American, and I would say male, but it should be for everyone, was to take apart a carburetor. I mean, that was sort of how
that's
you,
why I'm still infantile. I never did that.
And now we don't, suddenly we didn't have carburetors to take apart. We went to fuel injection, and there was this gap where I've been involved with some high school technology educator groups, which is shop teachers, and there was this interim where we said, okay, we're not going to do that stuff. It's all going to be CAD. We're not going to take anything apart with our hands. And that left us really missing something. So I'm very happy if I see a movement back to, yes, we can take our computers apart. We may not be able to, get in on the chip level, but there's still things we can do and build, and maybe it's the kind of stuff Freeman's talking about. Yeah. I should say that the real reason I left high school was I think being in the, and because she's not here, I can say it's being in Esther's shadow, and that there was no way to compete with her except leaving and doing something else. So I'm wearing Esther's shirt. So.
Right, well. Yeah. So if Esther were here, what would we be asking her? Yeah, what would she be answering? Is the other question.
Well, I think
can you channel her for a minute.
I would ask Esther how this is playing out in Eastern Europe and Russia. And that's really her her expertise, is what's going on in the rest of the world.
Mm-hmm. So coming back to questions of nuclear power, in your book Weapons and Hope, you talked a lot about questions of risk and safety. Right now, we're in an era where once again we are, facing various questions of risk. We were talking earlier this morning about the Department of Homeland Security. Could you talk a little bit about the whole idea of risk as it applies to our society and to technology as we come up with brilliant new ideas?
Well, of course, this we're living in a society that's amazingly risk averse, and at the same time does all sorts of crazy stuff. And that's it's a strange paradox. I mean, it's due to the fact that people don't really understand the nature of risk. And they think they can make their lives 100% safe. And at the same time, they just don't look at it quantitatively. And I guess you guys are all in the habit of looking at things quantitatively, so that's not a problem for you. But it certainly is for the society in general.
Right. Well, wasn't that Mitch Kapoor this morning referred to Marvin Minsky's comment that when they started the Department of Homeland Security, said what we really need is a Department of Homeland Arithmetic. Yeah.
No, the nuclear industry, of course, came to grief mostly just because you can't do things on a small scale. And that so... That's why open software is good, because it can be done on a small scale, and that's why it works. And of course, it's just a fact of nature that nuclear energy doesn't work on a small scale. And I think that was its Achilles heel.
That's a really interesting perspective. So you're saying that decentralization and the ability of individuals to get involved in projects is fairly central to the ultimate success of technologies.
Yes.
All right, so simple answer. I'm wondering if, I bet there's a lot of people here who have questions that they'd like to ask Freeman and George. So maybe we should just open up this session up to the audience. And it might be a little, we need to bring up the lights if we're going to do that. We should, maybe, can we do that? Bring up the lights and open the, yes, no? All right.
Mic here.
Oh, there's somebody at the mic there. Okay, I guess we're just not getting the lights. Okay, there. Okay.
Hello?
Yeah.
Freeman, as far as political issues, how about STEM research, stem cell research, and how that compares to biotechnology?
Well, of course, it's an important aspect. It's not probably as important scientifically as it is politically, but still, I mean, it is important. I think it's certainly a great enterprise, and it should be going forward, and I'm happy to see that the Democrats finally are raising their voices. It's it certainly has great possibilities. I mean, whether it will actually cure diseases or not, of course, is still completely unclear.
One of the things that brings up for me, I was reading that before you did some of your work on adaptive optics, which was obviously very important for astronomy, you did some investigation of the real risk of it being used for creating weapons. And you kind of evaluated the two possible uses.
Yes, I work quite a lot with the military, and therefore I always have to think whether it's good or bad, whether you get involved with such things. And adaptive optics is a good example of the pernicious effects of secrecy. This was a flourishing branch of science 30 years ago, which I was very much interested in. It's the idea is you make a rubber mirror, we call it a rubber mirror, it means a flexible membrane, which can be wiggled around fast enough to counteract the scintillations of the atmosphere as the light comes through it. So it's a means of getting clear pictures of the sky through a turbulent atmosphere from the ground. And so it obviously is very important for astronomy. So we were doing it for that about 30 years ago, and then the Defense Department got hold of this, and they thought they would use this for taking pictures of satellites from the ground. And so the whole thing was suddenly stamped secret. And that had the effect of halting progress for about 12 years. In the meantime, of course, the French, who were not bound by secrecy, went ahead. And so the French, in fact, are still leading the world as a result of that. And however, finally, wisdom prevailed, and the subject is now out in the open again, also in this country, and it's finally now being used and becoming very fruitful for astronomy. But when I was involved in it, of course, it was through the military period, and so I had to consider whether, in fact, the military were going to make evil uses of this, and it was quite clear that it was actually quite inconsequential, that as far as I could see, that the military uses were never, in fact, important. It was essentially, like most military projects, the secrecy hided failure rather than success.
Over here.
What are your current thoughts on the end of the universe?
Well, it's not looking good, I must confess.
Dr. Dyson, last year you were in Portland. I wrote to you afterwards, and you gave me a story about Ted Taylor and what I'd call a water purification hack that you did with saltwater snow. Since O'Reilly collects hacks, maybe you could share that hack or some other one with the rest of the crowd, because I was really entertained.
Yes, I wouldn't call that a hack. It was a very good idea, which founded just because we're not very good at marketing. That certainly marketing is not my strong suit, and it's not Ted's either. So this, the idea was that you can make fresh water out of seawater just by squirting it through a fog nozzle, essentially a snow machine, on cold nights in the winter. He was doing this at a place called Greenport in Long Island, which badly needs fresh water. And it was very successful technically. He was able to produce a huge volume of snow, which then, the idea is that the salt just trickles down through the snow as it thaws. And you end up with a big pile of potable snow. And all you have to do then is to get it into the public water supply system, which is not so simple. That's where the project actually failed. But anyhow, it's a good idea, but it still remains for the hackers to make use of it.
Yeah. Over here.
Speaking of biotechnology and the future, I'm sure you've probably heard what Bill Joy has said about it and how he's not very optimistic, how essentially we're doomed by 2070 to be overcome by our biotechnology. How do we avoid going down the path that he's so afraid of?
Well, just by being lucky, essentially. We always live on luck. That's the nature of life. It's the nature of evolution. It's all based on luck. So we just have to make the best of things. And I don't have any magic way of avoiding dangers. The point is, do you want to live a risk-free life? If you do, then you'd better just swallow the pill right away and get it over. So,
George, speaking of risk, what's the riskiest thing you've ever done?
Well, some of them have been driving. I didn't get my driver's license until I was 23, and that's a mistake. You sort of are it's too late. And drove down the Fraser Canyon in January, the day I got my license. That was scary. I think the really risky things, you don't know how risky they are. You don't know how close you came. But so I've done many near-death risky kayak things and so on, and climbing. You know, if you saw the film Touching the Void, the climbing, you know, the guy gets to the end of the rope and there's nothing there. That happened to me, but the ground was 6 feet below. But I think to the Bill Joy question, I mean, I've had this argument with Bill. The thing, you know, the things Bill Joy worries about, the things he's afraid of, I'm not afraid of. And the things that someone like Ray Kurzweil is proclaiming as being the positive future, those are the things that scare me.
And could you talk a little bit about that briefly, the whole debate about, you know, human-computer futures?
Well, yeah, I mean, the people who are pushing for an artificial intelligence that is just like human intelligence, I think that would be a great tragedy. I mean, we have enough human intelligence. If we're going to get some artificial intelligence, let's have something different and new. And the people who want it to sort of mirror human intelligence, or that the end goal of technology is to make humans immortal, I mean, I think that would be a very sad thing from the point of view of life as a whole, that life moves on to new things, and the fear that the bad guys are going to write viruses. I mean, that's like I live in this little tiny town called Bellingham, and the day after September 12th, I run past the Coast Guard base every morning. All the windows were taped up. I mean, as if someone is going to bomb the Bellingham Coast Guard.
When I was growing up, we were always worried about the communists coming over the back fences. You know, we built all kinds of weapons to fight them off.
Right. So I think Marvin Minsky was right. We just aren't weighing the risks. And of course, as a teenager, I didn't weigh them either.
So. Over here.
Hi. Like probably most of the people here, I'm a compulsive tinkerer, both with my hands and with my head. And that, you know, part from creative pride and part from being a bit of a control freak, which I don't know how many folks here this applies to. But as systems, both mechanical and biological, which are already complicated enough, become more and more complicated, do you see a point where they become beyond the capability of the human mind to appreciate, to the point where the kind of thing that one individual mind is capable of tinkering on, that mind can't appreciate the butterfly effect of their tinkering with something on the scale that they're capable of comprehending?
Well, that's always been true. I mean, the important things in the world are problems of society which we don't understand at all. And that's the art of living, that you develop a judgment for dealing with problems that you can't really understand. I don't think there's anything drastically different when you're dealing with machines than when you're dealing with societies. The machines will become more and more complicated, but they won't be as complicated as the societies that run them.
Interesting point. What about, though, there are certainly some technologies and some societies that have more knobs and levers. You know, for example, in a democracy, we theoretically have knobs and levers to control our government, versus in other systems, you know, there are fewer elements of control. So there are technological choices we can make that will have technology more open to tinkering or less. You have any thoughts on that subject? I mean, obviously you do in the sense that you've been talking about the domestication. But looking forward, is there any advice you can give us from past failures?
Well, I mean, off the cuff, I mean, the secret of government, of course, the secret of benign government is to have a division of powers so that there are three branches of your government which are essentially blocking the others from becoming dictatorial. That's at least the idea. And that works also in science and in civil society. I think it's very important in any industry to have a private sector and a public sector. Private sector by itself can do a lot, but the public sector can do a lot, but together they do much better.
And so that in some sense is a lesson for us that we shouldn't be thinking, oh, we've got to get rid of Microsoft. We just have to, you know, or any proprietary software company. That really open source and proprietary software both play roles in an ecosystem?
Yes. No, I just read a review article which I'd like to publicize by Carl Wozel, the biologist. It just came out in the July issue of the Reviews of Microbiology, a journal that most of you probably don't read. Anyhow, it's called A New Biology for a New Century. And it's putting the point that essentially Darwinian biology was an interlude, lasted 3 billion years, but it was only an interlude. And when life began, you had free software. You had genes freely transmitted from one little cell to another. They weren't yet really organisms. You didn't have species. You just had some kind of a community of cells sharing resources and sharing information and sharing their tricks. So the good ideas were spread from one cell all through the community. And then one day, some little cell found some proprietary tricks and set up its own platforms and became a species. And
Docs.
That's a perspective.
From there on, it was all downhill, of course. So the Darwinian process started with this kind of specialization of information, and that's how it's been for the last 3 billion years. And now we are free. Now we have the chance now again to establish a freedom of transfer, which of course raises all these dangers that Bill Joy worries about, but also gives us tremendous freedom to be creative.
It's a very interesting analogy. Wow. So, over here.
I have a question which is arguably more foundational and philosophical. Do you think that technology is a valueless tool which merely magnifies our ability to accomplish work for good or for evil? Or do you think some technologies are value-laden and actually use us?
Yes. Trouble with me is, I mean, for me, technology is just a tool. It doesn't have religious overtones, and so I can understand the sort of the mystical aspects of technology, but it's not something I'm aware of myself.
So, Doc.
Hi, this is for Freeman. About 20 some years ago, you gave a lecture at the University of North Carolina on Michael Polanyi, in which you divided scientists into unifiers and diversifiers. And it was fascinating, and I don't remember much about it, so I thought it would help me remember if you told all of us again at once, if that's still... And how you would divide up your own family members into one class or the other.
Yeah, well, you probably remember it better than I do, but... Anyhow, no, it's true, of course, that... You can divide scientists into discoverers and explainers, if you like. I mean, the people who go out and just look at the world and find out what's there and invent things with their hands to make things more complicated. And then there are the unifiers or the explainers who try to put it all together into some intellectual package. And I suppose that in my own household, in my own family, I would say we have a bit of both. But I'm certainly a diversifier.
So you referred to them as birds and frogs at one point, didn't
right,
you?
Yes, that wasn't my, actually, that wasn't my invention. I forget who invented that. But that's a good analogy. I mean, birds are the ones who look down from the sky, and frogs are those who look up from the mud. And
So, but speaking of that, I was really interested when I read that, because you talked about the connection between the diversifiers getting their hands dirty, but you also kind of described them a little bit as makers. And, you know, here's George, you know, who went off from science and into making things. Again, do you see a connection between, that process of discovery and the process of tool building and the like?
Oh, very strong, of course. And no, you said in everything George writes, you see that. But again, of course, the joke is that George himself is sort of by temperament a unifier, that he actually loves bringing things together and does it very well.
So where would you put Esther in that spectrum?
Yeah, I really don't know, because, I mean, certainly her sort of sense of adventure and going off and spending a lot of her time in Russia trying to teach the Russians to be good capitalists. I mean, that I think is marvelous, but it doesn't really come into this category.
All right. So let's see over here.
I have a question for both George and Freeman. What do you think is necessary for tinkering to start to happen in biotechnology so that I could go back into my greenhouse and make a new orchid?
Yeah, well, first you have to have kits. And I think that's coming along. And I mean, one of the just a few days ago, I saw the first genetically modified fish in a pet store, and beautifully colored tropical fish, which, of course, you don't yet have a do-it-yourself kit for doing that. But I think that's coming along very soon. So that's how it'll start. And then, of course, you can never tell how technology grows. That's the beauty of it. It's always unpredictable.
You really only need one thing to do genetic engineering. I mean, you need a computer and a credit card. If you get the back page of science, the cost per base pair just keeps dropping every 6 months. It's like Moore's law in reverse. And so eventually those two curves are going to intersect. You can already get substantial sequences. Just you can write them and phone in your credit card number, and you'll get the DNA. So it's we're definitely heading that way.
Yeah, you can buy DNA synthesizers. They're not, they're not for teenagers yet. But I don't know, the prices are in the tens of thousands of dollars, but they will come down.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like computing back in the 60s. I mean, it was still in the mainframe stage, but
we're about 40 years behind.
That's a sobering thought, because there are, of course, at least advertised a lot of risks that people could make organisms that don't do what intended. Then you get crossover. I mean, look at what's happening with some of the gene-engineered seeds. Think about Monsanto with the corn that won't reproduce or whatever. This spreads into the wild. This is not a good thing.
Well, why is it bad? That's the question.
Okay. You mean we create grain that no longer reproduces, can only be bought from the factory?
Well, I mean, there's all sorts of grains, of course, that are still around. That one is not going to do well in the state of nature.
That's a good point. let's see, we're over here.
Professor Dyson, as an educator, you've tutored, instructed a number of students, and I was wondering if you've seen a trend during your career at Princeton, whether the students have become more or less prepared for your classes and what you're there to teach them. I'm thinking specifically of a basis in classical education that was more prevalent earlier in the 20th century, and by the time I got into school, the great books really didn't seem to matter much, especially, even in in grammar school and high school, so people don't have a general exposure to past ideas, and we're just kind of plopped into the present and taught the skills of learning math and science, but not the background for human history back to the Greeks.
No, and of course I do less teaching than almost anybody else. So I learn far more from my grandchildren than from my students. But what you say is certainly true. And we lost a great deal, of course. But that's the nature of things, that every society has to lose a lot in order to have its mind still fresh to think new thoughts. You've got to discard a lot of the old. And it's nothing new in that either. You may be sad, but the grandchildren will find other things to do.
That's a really, I think, probably a good note on which to wrap. I think we're at time. Is that right, Jaina?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Well, so we just have to make it new. All right. Thank you very, very much, George and Freeman. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for listening to this special edition of IT Conversations. This edition was recorded at the O'Reilly Open Source Convention held in Portland, Oregon, July 26th through 30th, 2004. For more information regarding this and future O'Reilly conferences, visit conferences.oreilly.net. This program is copyright 2004 by the presenter, O'Reilly Media, and RDS Strategies, LLC. My name is Doug Kay, and I hope you'll join me next time for another edition of IT Conversations.